This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. The document Declaration of Rights and Sentiments marks a turning point in American history. Coming 72 years after the Declaration of Independence, it read in part, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal." The Declaration of Rights and Sentiments was drafted at a conference in Seneca Falls, New York, in 1848. It would be another 72 years before the 19th Amendment became part of the U.S. Constitution. Today on the program, we're going to take a look at the women who paved the way for the women's rights movement, including Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott, Lucy Stone, and Susan B. Anthony. Our guest is historian Sally McMillan. She is the author of Seneca Falls and the Origins of the Women's Rights Movement. Sally McMillan says while the issues discussed at Seneca Falls do not seem radical today, they were at the time. They were revolutionary. What did they include? Suffrage, the right to serve on juries, to hold public office, to be able to divorce, to claim their own possessions, to acquire a good education, earn equal wages, and pursue meaningful work. McMillan says the convention at Seneca Falls was of tremendous importance, a pivotal moment in our history. She says, quoting here, "It motivated a group of women and some men to demand justice and to seek the rights of citizenship for half the nation's population." Listeners, I encourage you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. They are invited. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Sally McMillan, our guest, is a professor of history and department chair at Davidson College in North Carolina. Her latest book, Seneca Falls and the Origins of the Women's Rights Movement, is published by the Oxford University Press. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Professor McMillan, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, it's my pleasure.
You focus on four women in the struggle for equal rights: Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott, Lucy Stone, and Susan B. Anthony. What put these four women and others like them on course to seek equal rights for women?
Well, they had different motivations for getting involved in the women's rights movement. Lucretia Mott was a Quaker, and she had been preaching for a number of years and had always embraced the anti-slavery movement. And in her discussion and talks to her public, she began to realize that women were almost as enslaved as men were. Almost as enslaved as slaves were. She met Elizabeth Cady Stanton at an anti-slavery convention in London, where there were eight women delegates from the United States, and they were excluded from that convention because they were female. And the two of them at that point in 1840 vowed that someday they would hold a convention to discuss the injustices that women faced. So it was 8 years later, finally, when they happened to get together at a tea party and vowed to hold a convention. And that convention met in July 19th and 20th, 1848. It was actually Lucy Stone did not join the women's rights movement until 1850, but she had been lecturing on anti-slavery and also interjected issues of women's rights in her various speeches. And she was committed to women's equality from the time she was young.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Well, and then I was just going to say, and Susan B. Anthony, who's sort of the most well-known woman of these four, actually was the last of the four women I focus on to join the movement, which was the next year when she met Elizabeth Cady Stanton in Seneca Falls. They became fast friends, and Anthony turned her direction in her life from working on the anti-slavery movement and on temperance causes to deal with women's rights. So they each, they each had some ties to anti-slavery, and they were just committed, well-educated women who recognized the injustices that women had been enduring for years.
Yeah, and the Declaration of Rights and Sentiments, that was the same name given the founding document of the American Anti-Slavery Society, so...
Yes, they used various documents as models, and obviously it was the Declaration of Independence that provided the closest parallel to what they were trying to achieve, but rather than denouncing King George III, they, of course, turned their attention to men and blamed them for all the injustices women faced.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian Sally McMillan. We have a listener joining us from Kankakee who would like to speak with us. So let's go there and talk with this listener in Kankakee, line 4. Good afternoon.
Thank you very much for taking my call. This is kind of an aside question, but could you explain the derivative of the word suffrage?
I can't explain the derivative of it. It means to vote.
Yes, I understand that, but how did they come up with the spread between to vote to suffrage?
I actually don't know. It was a word that they used, and I've just taken it from all the documents that I found.
Everybody I ask doesn't know, and I, you know, it's always been a curiosity of mine of where the word came from.
Well, what we need to do is get the OED out, I guess.
There you go.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I'll try that.
Okay, thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are invited, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. A couple of other remarkable reformers are part of this story, the Grimke sisters. Tell us about them.
Oh, they are wonderful. I think the remarkable thing about them initially was that these two sisters were from Charleston, South Carolina. Their father was wealthy, a judge, and a slave owner, and they were raised in a family of slaveholders. But they, from the very time they were little, they opposed slavery. They taught their slaves to read, which was, of course, against the laws in South Carolina. And after visiting Philadelphia, it was Sarah who decided to move there because she was drawn by Quakers. She was just drawn by Northern attitudes and, of course, a society where slavery was outlawed. So she moved there first and then was joined by her sister Angelina. And they began to write and speak about the problems of slavery, and their perspective was so unique because it was rare for the abolition movement to have two women, particularly women, who had been raised in a slaveholding family and knew firsthand what slavery was all about. So they, in writing about slavery and then particularly in lecturing against the evils of slavery, they began to draw criticism, particularly from New England ministers who were outraged that these two women would dare speak in public and speak to both men and women. This was just totally inappropriate behavior for women. And so they wrote, these ministers wrote a protest. They wrote a pastoral letter that they distributed to all the churches denouncing these two women. And what the Grimke sisters then realized is that women were as enslaved as the slaves they were trying to free.
Now, so here we have the intersection of the two issues, abolition and women's rights.
Exactly.
And what kind of a storm did they stir? They stirred up a big one. Tell us about the second annual anti-slavery convention of American women held in Philadelphia in May of 1839.
Oh, they did. They did stir up trouble. this meeting was held in this brand new hall in Philadelphia. The hall had been built specially to welcome sort of more radical causes, because conventions were very popular in this time period. We don't have internet, we don't have television back in the 1830s. This was a major form of entertainment. And so these women held this convention, again, to talk about anti-slavery, and they welcomed both black and white women and also men. And in holding this convention, there had been protests developing against this convention. And by the time the convention was actually held, men were gathering in, you know, big gangs of men were gathering, and they finally just invaded this convention. And they were so outraged by what was happening that they began to throw things and utter outrageous remarks and drown out speakers. And then eventually, despite the efforts by the local sort of police and the mayor, who actually did very little but was very concerned about the growing melee, these men burned the entire hall down, and that was the end of this wonderful structure that was supposed to welcome all speakers.
Yeah. So the mixing of men and women and black and white was really radical.
It was very radical, yes. It was, and particularly the idea that women would be speaking to men and women, and then the idea of racial mixing. So even in the North, you had some some major racial underpinnings of chaos, of misunderstanding, of racism that was very pervasive in many of these conventions. But this in particular, the one you mentioned, is, of course, caused the most melee and the greatest damage ever.
Yeah. So were these women in fear of their lives?
Well, they must have been, but what they tried to talk about was being brave. I mean, particularly Lucretia Mott, who was just this demure, small woman with just this indomitable personality. And her main thing was to, you know, just exhibit this kind of inner strength that she had. I think a lot of it came from her faith, from being such a strong Quaker. But of course they must have been frightened. I mean, her life was threatened. Her family's home was threatened to be burned down. They couldn't help but be scared some of the time. They were incredibly brave and bold because, of course, they encountered all kinds of protests and all kinds of resistance for years and years. Hmm. I'm in awe of them, absolutely
yeah.
in awe.
Yeah. Well, when you start to read these stories, you're sitting very comfortably in your armchair and you're thinking, oh, my God.
Yes, and I mean, having been a sort of a part of the ERA and tried to, you know, get that passed long ago, nothing compared to what these women went through. And, of course, they were few in number, and they just didn't give up. They were absolutely indomitable. It's really an amazing story.
Let's take another call. A listener in Charleston, line one, hi.
Hello. First, I'll say this is a very interesting program. Thank you for having a speaker on this topic. I just wanted to comment on the previous caller's question, which has a pretty simple answer, I think. I'm a teacher of literature, and being familiar with older literature, Shakespeare and the Bible, etc., I can tell you that suffer meant permit. As in, suffer the little children to come unto me in the Bible, which means let the children come. And suffrage was a word that meant permission, and it was used for both male and female voting in our history.
It was, yes.
So it simply means permission or allowing the women to vote or allowing whether it's women or men or whoever to vote. And that's a sort of obsolete meaning now of the word suffer, so that everybody tends to associate suffer with undergoing pain. But the meaning at the root of woman's suffrage has nothing to do with undergoing pain, but is just about permitting or allowing the women to vote. So
thank you. I'm happy to have that information.
Okay, and it would be in the OED, but I could just, you know, from my familiarity with older literature, tell you that that was a very common usage of the word suffer, just to mean permit.
Well, thank you for the call, and thank you for the information. And I hope our listener in Kankakee is still with us. He's a happy man, I would imagine, this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, historian Sally McMillan, author most recently of Seneca Falls and the Origins of the Women's Rights Movement. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question, a comment, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, maybe we should go back a little bit further now, back to the American Revolution and the government created in its wake. This, you say, resulted in a more rigid definition of gender roles. Talk with us about that. I thought that was very interesting.
Well, what began to be articulated, particularly in the early part of the 19th century, was this concept of separate spheres and a particular role for women, particularly as more men began to go out of the home to engage in wage work. There began to be articulated in popular magazines and sermons and all that, the idea that a woman really had a role to play in the home. She was to be sort of the obedient individual in the home, the maternal, pious, chaste woman who took care of her husband, her household, her family. And that was her major role, while her husband engaged in the world of business, of wage labor, of politics, of debates and all of that. So you began to develop this concept of separate spheres. Now, that, of course, was changeable. I mean, you can't say that it applied to every family and every couple. But it began to be a very sort of common perception of the ideal woman who would engage in her separate sphere. Before that, there wasn't this strong articulation of that particular role, and also in the colonial period, women may have been, and they were considered secondary to men, but they often played a very important role in the development of communities, in establishing a home in the New World, etc. So there was less sort of need to create an articulated idea of where women should place themselves in the social order.
Yeah. So, and if I'm recalling correctly, let's say in the Mott family, or it would have been the Coffin family, the father was away often, correct?
Yes, he was a whaling captain.
Yes.
And they lived on Nantucket Island, and so he was away a great deal of the time. And so his wife, Lucretia's mother, was the one who, they had a little family store, a business, and she took care of all the household matters and raised the children while her husband was away for months at a time on these lengthy whaling voyages. So a woman, you know, a girl growing up like Lucretia did in a household where her mother just by necessity sort of ran everything, she began to develop a very strong perception of the strength that women had to have to survive and also how important it was that women be, you know, have some sense of independence.
Yeah. Were women's rights debated at the birth of the Republic?
I wish they had been. No, it was, I mean, there were little sort of snippets of complaints. I mean, certainly we know about Abigail Adams and remember the lady mm-hmm. she wrote to her husband, John. And so there were a handful of women who would write in letters about women's rights and needs and a few men who articulated the same thing. But that never translated into larger issues about really dealing with what was being created in the 1780s, in writing the Constitution, or in writing the Declaration in 1776, you know, when Jefferson wrote "All men are created equal," it wasn't as if anybody then debated whether he really meant men or not. It wasn't even an issue at that time. We, of course, very much look at that statement and, you know, think about it and what it means today. But at the time, it really was. It was a male-dominated world, and that was the norm. So the idea of women having rights, women having equality with men, was not an issue. It would have been nice if the Constitutional Convention had considered it, yeah. But they didn't.
Let's talk with some more listeners. Next, we go to a listener on line one in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. I am a Quaker, so I'm glad you're giving us some credit, but I wanted to point out a few things that one of the reasons Quaker women were so active in the anti-slavery and suffrage movements is because women regularly spoke in meeting for worship and meeting for business, unlike in other churches. And at the time, there were no Quaker meetings that had what we now call programmed meetings. So all of it was silent meetings. So women were equally seen as ministers to men, and they were thus well prepared to speak to both men and women and accustomed to doing so. And the Grimke sisters, it's my understanding, both became Quakers, and where they were welcomed, and they could further hone their skills of speaking in that atmosphere. And then I was going to mention Nantucket, which you did. It was not just Lucretia's family, but it was largely settled by Quakers, is my understanding, Nantucket Island. And the main business was whaling, so most of the men were away for often years at a time. And the women took care of all the ordinary roles on the island, not storekeeping. I don't know if they held office, but they pretty much kept the infrastructure and the families going. So Lucretia grew up in that, not just in her family, but the whole society was like that. And then my last point is at the Tea Party, where the Seneca Falls Convention was planned. It was at the home of Lucretia's sister, and four of the five women there were Quakers, or at least raised Quaker, and the only exception was Elizabeth Cady Stanton.
Yes, almost everything you say is absolutely correct, and I do go into those kinds of details in my book. I think also, yes, I mean, Lucretia Mott was a Quaker minister. And you also, the Quakers believed in co-ed education, which was very rare at that time.
Right.
And Quaker Lucretia and her sister attended a co-ed school, but so did most Quaker women. And this was just the norm. And yes, the Grimke sisters did become Quakers in Philadelphia. They were very drawn to that faith. And Nantucket, yes, was very much a whaling community. The Tea Party that sort of fostered the idea to hold the Seneca Falls Convention was actually at the home of a woman named Jane Hunt. She lived in right outside of Seneca Falls, and she was quite a wealthy woman, and she invited Lucretia and her sister and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and one other woman to this Tea Party. But you're right, four of the women were Quakers. Only Stanton was not, which is kind of interesting considering her large role in the movement later. But
right.
Yes, I give Quakers lots of credit for all that happened.
Well, and Susan B. Anthony was also raised Quaker.
Her father was Quaker, that's right. But she did not remain a Quaker.
She never joined.
No, right.
The
he married outside of faith, which created
her.
A little problem.
What?
Susan B. Anthony's mother was not a Quaker.
Oh, okay.
So
yeah,
that created
in those
just
days
a...
that was problematic.
Exactly, right, yes.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you for calling.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call this afternoon. Next, we take another call, a listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hi. I had two questions. My first is, was there a decisive moment in each of these women's lives that brought on this issue for them? And my second question is, for the women who did not have a male presence in their family, how did they navigate through life in a very male-dominated society? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank
you. Good questions.
Those are very good questions and huge questions. With Elizabeth Cady Stanton, I would say it's very hard to pick one moment when she really saw women's rights as an issue that she embraced with passion. There were many episodes in her life. Actually, I start the book with a moment when she was 11 years old, and her older brother, Eliezer, has just died, the last of the Cady sons to die, leaving Elizabeth Cady Stanton's father, Judge Cady, without a male heir. He had, you know, sort of pinned all his hopes on his sons. And Elizabeth, at least in the retelling, in the autobiography or the memoir she wrote about herself, said that that was the moment when she vowed that she would do everything a male could do, that she would try to get the education, she would try to, you know, have as many successes in her life as men could do and try to please her father. Now, of course, she encountered all kinds of problems and challenges in order to achieve that, but she actually did, of course, as we know, go on to incredible fame with her efforts in the women's rights movement. Lucretia Mott, I don't think there's one particular moment when suddenly she embraced women's rights. Having just talked to the previous caller, I hope you got a sense of the fact that just being a Quaker and seeing this strong mother of hers, getting a good education, made her so aware of what women could achieve. And then this 1840 anti-slavery convention, meeting Elizabeth Cady Stanton and being shut out from serving as a delegate, certainly prompted her to begin to take action and to see that a convention was a necessity. For Lucy Stone, and I love Lucy Stone, I think she's been left out of most accounts in terms of having a prominent role, but she's so important. Again, I don't see one particular issue, but she was always bent upon having a really superior education, and she found in doing so and in asking her parents to send her to school that they felt that by the time she was 16, she'd achieved more than enough education. She had this very determined personality. She was very strong-willed, and I think she you know, she just saw this need to be educated and to be the equal of her brothers, I think, was a major part of her upbringing. But there are many other incidents. For instance, not being paid fairly when she taught in school, not being given a voting membership in her church, hearing this protest that these New England ministers wrote to protest the Grimke sisters. She heard that read in her own church. There were just many episodes that I think sort of galvanized her thinking.
Yeah, it seems for all these women that they were sensitive to injustice at a fairly early age.
They were, and I think also each of them getting quite a substantial education for women of their time. Again, you know, when you give people opportunities and open a few windows, which is what happened with their education, I think they began to see much larger possibilities.
And now to the next question that the listener posed about life as a single woman, as a spinster.
Well, okay, I wasn't quite sure of the meaning of the question because, first of all three of the four women were married. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott, and Lucy Stone all married. It wasn't only Lucretia Mott had a really supportive husband. He was a Quaker. They shared many of the same ideals. He very much supported her work, recognized her important role in both the anti-slavery movement and the women's rights movement. Elizabeth Cady Stanton was not as fortunate. Her husband, Henry, I think at times was somewhat embarrassed by his bold wife. She was always coming up with new ideas and had just a strong, very strong commitment to this movement, at least in writing for the first decade. And then later she got involved in it beginning in 1860. And Lucy Stone's husband, Henry, also embraced the movement. He was difficult in that he didn't really earn much of a living, and so much of their income kind of depended on Lucy. But he was very supportive of the movement and became very involved in it, particularly in the 1870s and 80s, played a very important role in it. So only Susan B. Anthony was a femme soul, a woman who had no husband, but she had tremendous friendships with other women, I think, that provided her a lot of kind of support she needed.
Hmm. How was she able to make her way?
Oh, I've never felt she had any problem in doing that. She had a very strong personality. You know, she and Elizabeth Cady Stanton kind of in a way teamed up initially when Elizabeth Cady Stanton's children were still young and Stanton couldn't really involve herself in the movement, such as lecturing or participating at conventions. She was sort of the intellectual, the brain behind the movement, and Susan B. Anthony went out and delivered the messages and did the petitioning and, you know, delivered lectures and attended conventions in Stanton's stead. So they had this really interesting friendship. But Stanton just did amazing things. She had enormous energy, and she would make these long treks to the West and give lectures and, you know, try to arouse people to this cause, and went through New York State in the middle of winter trying to get petitions signed for women's suffrage. She was amazing. So I just marvel at these women. I think they are just incredible.
Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Just to say that there's still fallout from some of the people your book describes. Just a couple of years ago on a horse-drawn carriage tour of Beaufort, South Carolina, our tour guide badmouthed the Grimkes.
Oh, dear.
Yes.
Oh, no. What did this...
Oh, well, they were just so ugly. And I was just stunned to hear this, what I would call a neo-Confederate comment.
Oh, dear.
Yep.
I'm so sorry.
Well, I knew about them before I heard the comment.
Did you say anything?
Not detail, just that smart aleck zinger. But what I really wanted to do was kind of add in some historical context to the conference in Seneca Falls. I mean, this was the year, I think, the Mexican War ended.
Absolutely.
And
right.
the year later, 1849, was the California Gold Rush.
Absolutely.
And 1850, the hideous Fugitive Slave Act. So I just thought I'd throw that into the mix to see what this conference added to the national turmoil that was already going on.
Well, it was right in the heart of it, and I actually that's mentioned in, I think, the first chapter of my book, where this year of 1848 was enormous. And, of course, all of this occurred right in the middle of sort of what we see as this sort of radical, reforming, religious upheaval that's going on in the United States. And it was a very exciting time in our nation's history. So this convention is just another chapter in all of that sort of fascinating chaos, that had so many political and social repercussions over time.
And the modern day tragedy is that a lot of places around the world aren't even up to the issues discussed in this convention back in 1848.
Isn't that the truth? I know. And we think of women's status in so many countries, and you know, it just makes you weep to think what they don't have.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for the call. Next, we take a listener's call from Champaign, line 2. Hi.
Hi, this is the Quaker calling back. I wanted to say something else about Lucy Stone. She was married to Henry Blackwell, I believe.
Yes.
And he came from a very feminist family.
Yes.
I believe one or both or two of his many sisters were the first female medical doctors in the United States.
Yes, Elizabeth and then her sister Emily.
Right. And Lucy kept her name. She and Henry decided together that she would keep her name. And so women that kept their name were known as Lucy Stoners.
Right.
And when I kept my name in 1965, my mother and mother-in-law were born in the, 1899 and 1907, still knew what that meant, but most people had no idea, because when women got the vote, they sort of went to sleep for 50 years and thought they'd gotten equality. And then another thing about Lucretia, she met James Mott at a Quaker boarding school where I believe she had attended, and then she subsequently taught there, and he also taught there.
That's right.
And,
yes.
I think part of her sense of injustice was awakened when she discovered she either earned nothing or almost nothing, and the men were paid, and they were paid a standard wage. And they did the same thing. This was co-ed in the sense that there were both men and women and boys and girls there, but the schools were separated.
They did not attend classes
from the girls.
Together. That's right. Yes.
And this is a story our guest Sally McMillan tells in the book. Tell us about the differences in the wages paid.
Well, for teachers, it was substantial. A male teacher would be paid anywhere from 2 to 4 times what a female earned. It was just incredible injustice. And, of course, Susan B. Anthony, Lucy Stone, Lucretia Mott all faced this in teaching school. And it really, really got Susan B. Anthony in particular upset at how poorly she was paid. But this is one reason in part why the teaching profession became feminized, because women began to get better educated, and in doing so they became eligible to teach school, and school districts and private academies could, of course, pay women a far lower wages than they paid men, and so they began to hire women as teachers. So in part, women's major entry into the teaching profession had to do with the fact that they were paid far less than men were.
Yeah, and
but fortunately, it's much better today.
Yeah. The caller alluded to Elizabeth Blackwell. That's another wonderful story that you've included in the book. Tell us how she got into Geneva College.
Well, it was a fluke. Elizabeth was determined to become a doctor during a time period when women did not become doctors. They certainly did not go to medical school. They were not allowed to go to medical school. But she was determined, and she applied to a number of medical schools, including Geneva College. And the college, in receiving her application, thought it was a joke, that perhaps some rival medical school had sent this in as a joke. And so the officials received it, and I think they actually turned it over to the students, and they all together sort of decided, ho-ho, this is a joke, and we'll admit this, this person, Elizabeth Blackwell. And lo and behold, of course, Elizabeth shows up, and she's a female. And at that point, I think the school decided, well, we better keep her. But she, of course, always sat at the back of the class. And it was a real struggle for her because, of course, she faced discrimination, and she faced discrimination in the community as well, knowing, you know, people knew that she was this female who was attending this school that was supposed to be for men only. But she did earn her medical degree, and then she went to Europe to study, you know, further. And then her sister, Emily, younger sister, was able to attend medical school. And it's not at all surprising that the two of them eventually opened a women's medical college in New York City that only admitted women.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, historian Sally McMillan, author of Seneca Falls and the Origins of the Women's Rights Movement. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, what was the situation in the antebellum period for women of color, black women, slave and free?
It was pretty miserable. Of course, slaves, almost all of whom were in the South, had no rights. I mean, they were owned by an individual, and they had no freedoms at all. They were at the beck and call of their masters. Some slave women, of course, were the victims of sexual predation. They lived in usually fairly miserable huts. They worked dawn to dusk. Their children, of course, automatically became slaves. And they, you know, imagined a life for themselves of perpetual slavery. They were able to make a life for themselves of some sorts by, you know, using their culture, their religion, their sense of community to, you know, give them some sense that life had some kind of meaning. And free women, free black women, in both the North and the South, faced discrimination just in terms of, you know, job opportunities. Most of them were domestics. They worked as cooks. They worked as laundresses. Some of them were single mothers. Some of them were single women. And they, too, faced discrimination. They weren't allowed to ride on public transportation. Just, you know, the horrors of being black in the antebellum U.S.
Hmm.
It was a very, very difficult life.
Yeah.
But then we have a few heroines like Sojourner Truth, of course, who got involved in the women's rights movement and was able to articulate some of her frustrations and her desire for equality.
Yeah.
Pretty admirable woman.
Yeah. Well, what were the relations between black women and white women when it came to the abolitionist movement and the fight for women's rights?
Well, there were some women who were involved in the Philadelphia Women's Anti-Slavery Society, and there were black women who formed their own anti-slavery societies in the North. And as we talked about much earlier, this hall where this convention was held, which attracted both black and white women to it. But there was not a strong sense of sisterhood at this point. Certainly the abolitionists like Lucretia Mott were, of course, concerned about freeing women from slavery and freeing men from slavery, but their paths didn't cross often in terms of their interaction. And what you see eventually in the evolution of the women's suffrage movement is that this was not a movement that really attracted black women, not until really the late 19th century, but during the period I study, black women did not play a very large role in this movement.
Seneca Falls, 1848, the Declaration of Rights and Sentiments is drawn up. What does the Declaration look like through the eyes of the 21st century?
Well, I find it inspiring, but I'm a historian, so I always try to, think about what life was like when this document was written and what it must have, how radical it must have been.
Mm-hmm.
But it is also, it's very reassuring to read. I actually include it at the end of my book, because I think it's important for everybody to read it and to realize when you read the clauses and the demands and the resolutions for change, how far we've come. We're still not 100% there. But when you read about what women didn't have, what rights they were denied, this is all in this Declaration of Sentiments, and it's very inspiring to think that we really have put most of this behind us in terms of what opportunities women have today. So I find it a very inspiring document.
Yeah. Also, though, as you know, to us, it can look undemocratic.
You mean, in what respect?
In where these women at Seneca Falls place themselves in terms of others.
You mean in terms of their own privilege and sense?
Yes,
absolutely. Yeah. They were women of their time, and they were women of their class. And so what I found happening sometimes in the movement and sometimes in their writings, like in the Declaration of Sentiments, is that they do express some intolerance for the less educated, the immigrants, African Americans. This came out particularly in the 1860s and 70s when they become very condemning of immigrant men and black men and all of that. So yes, there is a sense of their own status within those documents.
Well, let's take another call. A listener in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hi. I've been a student of the women's suffrage movement in the United States for some time, but I've always been curious about the significance of Seneca Falls. I don't know much about this area, and I'm wondering, was this an area that was very tolerant of movements such as the women's movement? Were these women there because they were suspect in the bigger cities of the East Coast at that period of time? What's going on to stimulate this kind of movement in that part of the country? Thank you.
That's a great question. And I do address it in my book, because when you think about this tiny little, you know, town today off the interstate, you kind of wonder that this was actually the center for this convention, that this is actually where it happened. But this was a very exciting area. In 1848, really beginning with the opening of the Erie Canal, which was very close to Seneca Falls. And in fact, Seneca Falls had a connector canal that went up to the Erie Canal. But the Erie Canal opened this whole area to transportation, to farming, et cetera. And, of course, it's very, very rich farmland. So it became economically, quite a prosperous area. It also was the center of what was called the Burned-Over District, and there were a number of religious revivals there. You know, it's not at all unusual this is where the Mormon faith started. This is where a number of communitarian or utopian societies had their origins. This is where a man like William Miller, who started a whole religious movement, lived. So it's an area of reform, of religion, of really excitement for that particular time period. And it attracted a number of Quakers. And it wasn't that Quakers were leaving because so much they felt discontent, but again, it was just the attraction of this area. And as more and more Quakers settled there, of course, it attracted more and more of them. So it's an interesting area of vibrancy and excitement. And the fact that four of the women who really, who were responsible for holding the convention were Quakers, I think reflects, what's happening in that area. The Stantons had moved there the year before. Henry Stanton had lived in Boston, and Henry Stanton had sort of dreams of doing better than he was doing. He wanted a healthier environment. He wanted to really have a place where politically and socially he could make a difference. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton's father happened to have a house he had bought, and he gave it to he actually gave it to Elizabeth. He didn't trust his son-in-law, but he handed it over to Elizabeth. And so this became sort of a free house for them to live in, where they really remained until the 1860s.
Hmm. And we've got to wrap up here, so I can only give you about a minute. But
okay.
What happens to this document in later years, let's say 1850 to 1860, 1860 on?
Well, I found that very reassuring, that it was referred to, it was celebrated, it was read at conventions. This document was not just used once at Seneca Falls in 1848, but in subsequent conventions, women saw this as an important document. And in fact, at one point, one man suggested they rewrite it, and he was, totally overruled, outvoted by trying to do that. So they saw this document as very, very important and really central to what they were trying to achieve.
Yeah, there we've got to leave it. We're out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon, and I want to tell our audience that tomorrow on this program we're going to talk about another remarkable reformer, Alice Paul. We will talk with a biographer of Alice Paul, one of the founders of the Congressional Union, a suffragist. And there we have to leave it today with Sally McMillan. Thank you so much for talking with us this
afternoon. Thank you.
Sally McMillan is the author of Seneca Falls and the Origins of the Women's Rights Movement. The book is published by the Oxford University Press.